Nagging questions remain in Congress on whether it really did anything useful to prevent another 2008-like financial meltdown. Now, an unlikely pair of senators, Republican John McCain and Democrat Elizabeth Warren, think it's time to have the government re-regulate banking in a way the Dodd-Frank bill did not. They're thinking back to Glass-Steagall. More now from Roll Call senior editor David Hawkins, and this seems to be a late development in this whole process, but talk about bipartisan.
Yes, it is a late development, and it's also a repeat development. McCain and Warren have actually been trying to get this sort of strange bedfellow bill off the ground for a couple of years now. You know, you're right to point out that when two lawmakers who would seem to have nothing or little in common get together on a bill, it tends to get publicity, and it tends to get, you know, some co-sponsorships. There was the whole criminal justice reform effort last year was spearheaded by Democrat Cory Booker and Republican Rand Paul, for example, and got pretty close to enactment. Anyway, what's different this year is that McCain and Warren say that they have received back-channel assurances from the Trump administration that they would be for this. And if the Trump people become very clear about this, if the president himself or Gary Cohn or Treasury Secretary Mnuchin actually come out and say in so many words, it's time to put back the barrier between traditional banking and brokerage, which is what reinstating Glass-Steagall would do in effect, then yes, that would be a big deal, and potentially, you know, it would rise quickly to the top of the list of big deal pieces of legislation that President Trump might get done.
So this would rearrange all of the regulatory apparatus in the government that has coalesced around the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which was signed by Bill Clinton, of all people.
That was another strange bedfellows moment. It was the Republican Congress under Newt Gingrich, really, or at least got off the ground when Newt Gingrich was the speaker, and Bill Clinton, who finally got the repeal of Glass-Steagall done, and that had been under discussion for, you know, a decade or longer, but probably longer. And then, as you pointed out, as we started talking, it was that lowering of the barriers that essentially allowed banks to get into the investment banking business more emphatically and to do brokerage stuff that is. And real estate, most importantly, that many people see as helping fuel the ill-considered lending that in turn led to the financial crisis.
The Securities and Exchange Commission then would get back, I guess, to looking at some of the banking side, which would be separated from commercial banking, that is investment banking, totally different animal than commercial banking.
That's right. I mean, how exactly the regulatory regime would be reinstated, whether it would be reinstated the way it was in the mid-1990s. I'm not sure the bill, to be honest, I have not read the bill in that kind of detail to see whether they would just do a do-over and go back to the way things were 20 years ago. But certainly it would need to be something kind of like that.
And switching gears here, there's been some development in the White House with respect to what it's going to let people see or not see, which is the visitor logs. This is a reversal of policy that had been in place under the Obama administration. Has it raised cackles on Capitol Hill? Do they care as much as some of the interest groups in public over who goes to the White House?
Oh, I think, you know, I think the Democrats care. I think this will be, the reaction to this on the Hill will be more or less along partisan lines. It is true that it is President Obama's administration that was the exception, not the rule, that it was the Obama administration that opened up the visitor's logs to public scrutiny late in the president's first term. Even after that, a federal court ruled on lawsuits that had been brought when George W. Bush was president, and a bunch of public interest research groups and had sued saying they needed to be public. The federal courts actually ruled that they didn't need to be made public. So the President Trump is now on pretty solid ground as far as the courts go. But the Obama administration said in the interest of transparency, we would have things open more or less. It was not a blanket openness. There were exceptions made for national security and super personal matters. And in other words, the identities of the Obama daughter's play dates when they came to the White House were not disclosed, and neither were the identities of, you know, if anybody who was covert or in a top secret mission came to the White House. Those identities weren't. Mr. Trump his administration has declared that this entire reinstatement of the secrecy is based on national security. You know, I think it's not being too opinionated to say that's just way an overstatement. There are plenty of visitor logs, plenty of visitors to the White House who have nothing to do with national security, but who do have to do with matters that some would say are involved with draining the swamp, i.e. campaign donors who might come to the White House. And so the president is shielding them as well. And using the national security claim seems a bit of a stretch.
We're speaking with senior editor David Hawkins of Roll Call. And I guess related to that is what goes on at Mar-a-Lago, because a lot of the visitors to the quote-unquote White House never get to the White House, like the Chinese president. They go to Mar-a-Lago and never go to Washington.
Yeah, well, that is a whole different issue. It was a fascinating issue, which is, you know, yes, on the one hand, the president is getting, he's getting pilloried from the left mainly for spending so much time, so many weekends down at Mar-a-Lago, for starting to rack up a weekend travel budget that, if it keeps going at this rate, will exceed in the first year of his presidency what Obama spent on sort of personal weekends away in his entire 8 years. You know, some of that, I think, can be rebutted pretty easily by what the White House says, which is the president's the president no matter where he is. And it's not, the president is never really on vacation, et cetera, et cetera. What's more interesting, which is, I think, what you were getting at, is that Mar-a-Lago is a private club that, since the president was elected, they have doubled the admission fee from $100,000 to $200,000. They are not obligated to say who has been admitted to this private club. And so now, for $200,000 and a few letters of reference, you can, mingle with the president on the weekends without any public scrutiny at all.
Well, I know that when driving by there, it's a pretty tight little curve when you cross the Intercoastal Waterway on Southern Boulevard, and then there's Flagler Drive and then A1A, and right in the middle of all that intersection, there's Mar-a-Lago. I think the locals probably wish some of it would go away. But
yeah, I do. I have friends down there who say there's now... there are a lot of relatively well-heeled elderly doyens and families who have learned about things like Slack and other and instant messaging apps, and they send one another instant messaging apps about when the motorcade's coming through and when it's safe to go to the beach.
And one thing I also wanted to ask you about that is being reported in Roll Call, and that is the Air Force being penny wise and pound foolish, or so it seems, in grounding a third or a quarter of its fleet of transport C-5s, billions of dollars worth of planes grounded to save tens of millions of dollars.
Yep, but thank you for bringing that up. A terrific story by my colleague, John Donnelly, who's our senior defense writer. Yes, exactly right. These are C-5s that were all refurbished, a whole fleet of C-5s, the largest plane in the Air Force fleet. It's the giant mammoth tanker that can take, I think, as many as six helicopters. I mean, its cargo bay is big enough to carry six attack helicopters at once. They were all refurbished a few years ago at a cost of some $2 billion. And now the Pentagon says, because of the, quote, tight defense budget, end quote, they can't afford to put these things up in the air. They've actually got to have them grounded. They turn on the motors. It's like they go out to the driveway and turn over the engine in the car once in a while that they're never going to drive, and then turn it back off. This is, it's a PR thing that'll cut both ways. On the one hand, defense hawks say this is what happens when we don't get the defense budget we want. We can't even afford to put these planes up in the air that we have just bought and paid for. The other side of the coin, of course, is some who would say, well, then why did you shouldn't have refurbished these things at a cost of $2 billion. If you couldn't pay to operate them, you should have made smarter budget decisions. And this is just an example of how the Pentagon budget is uncorralled. So politically, this will be an interesting... I'm sure that John's story will come up in debates on the spending bills ahead, including when Congress comes back next week and has to decide on a final defense number for the fiscal year that's now almost half over.
I guess the question is, if there's a quarter of them that are grounded with no ill effect, why do we need them in the first place?
Well, exactly right. Why didn't we spend the $2 billion on something else if we don't need them in the first place? Exactly.
Well, maybe
right.
United Airlines can squeeze a lot of people on them if they repaint them. David Hawkins is senior editor at Roll Call. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Find links to more and to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive.